the internet was, if we look at this graph, it goes back to 1957. It really was something that was created as part of a military initiative. The idea was, if we have a nuclear holocaust, which is what we were worried about back in the 50s, remember everybody was doing the crawling under the tables and practicing in case a nuclear explosion went off. The fear was that if that happened, then whatever materials, whatever information we had at a military base, wherever that nuclear explosion happened, would be decimated. And so they said, well, what about if we created some way, since we got so much information on the internet, some way that we could interface between those places. So all of the information maybe that's at Nellis Air Force Base versus at Langley Air Force Base, they could share that information. So if we know we've got 5 minutes, then we can download all that information, or maybe we can automatically share it all the time. So it was really created as a military project. And it continued to be a military project for quite a while. And by 1969, they had actually taken it from an idea, from a concept. Now look at, we went in, it took us 12 years from idea and concept to a reality. And what they had at that point, by 1969, is 4 computers in different geographic locations that were connected via what they called ARPANET, A-R-P-A, which stands for the Advanced Research Projects Agency. Their ARPANET connected 4 machines. Now, of course, we've got 4 machines connected right here. That's nothing for us, but this was a huge, huge deal, because this is the first time people could communicate. Think, you know, we're talking about using the internet to do, using browser searches that are heavily graphic-based. We can watch a video online. What that meant at that time is they could maybe send an email, or, you know, send one file from one person to another. I could say hi on my computer, and they could read it 10 minutes later on theirs, maybe. Okay, so this is very, very ancient technology by today's standards. It was in 1972 that email and the internet appeared publicly for the first time at the Internet Computer Communications Conference. So we go from 1969 to 1972. So now it's gone from 12 years to 3 years, and they say, there's this thing now called email. So we're going from there was only snail mail to now you can use your computer. And of course, at this point, it's only people who are really, really involved in computing who can do it. Nobody that's the average Joe citizen like us can do it. But it's introduced as a possibility. We go up, and in 1973 and 74, this technology, this method of technology transfer called TCP/IP, it doesn't really matter what it means, it's established. And what that TCP/IP does, and we still use TCP/IP today, is it allows you to take a packet of information. So it could be email, it could be a picture, it could be a file, and move it from one computer electronically to another. And so that could be over a cable, however. But what it is it's a protocol. It's an internet protocol. That's the IP part, internet protocol. And it's rules that we use. So whenever you move things from one place to another, there are certain methods and rules that you use it. So at this point, back in 1974, they finally had some common rules that we could use to move things around. So it seems like things are going really slowly, but the reality of it is these are huge, huge changes in the way that we think. Because in the past, you had to physically have a person move from one place to another place to give you some piece of written information. Okay, we'll go up in our timeline to 1984. That one, we start getting domain names and servers, so like unlv.edu or keelers.com. But they really, it wasn't like that. It was much more simple. So we might have, like, if you have a cox.net account where you would have your email. So that would be your domain name. So for UNLV, all of you have an email address. And your email address is your first initial last name at unlv.nevada.edu. That would be a domain name. So those were established at that time. The idea that we are all connected within a given domain. We have a relationship within a domain. That could be like juno.com or cox.net, gmail.com. And of course, all those came later. Next, and this is where it really starts to become exciting. In 1989, NSFNet, which is the National Science Foundation, really became the primary hub of what's going on the internet. This is huge, because up to this point, it was really a military infrastructure. It was something the military had created, the military was in control of. The military really needed it militarily, but maybe they didn't see a lot of potential for the general public. The National Science Foundation said, you know what, we've got so much cool research going on, but we really can't share our data very quickly. If I'm doing studies here and you're doing studies there, it takes forever for us to share that information. What about if we could increase the speed of knowledge transmission by using this tool that you've created? So the National Science Foundation becomes the leader in what's going on in the internet and in the development of that. That's huge. In 1991, then, the World Wide Web was released. This is the same World Wide Web that you're looking at now, was created by a man who was working at a place called CERN, C-E-R-N, and that, for the first time, took what NSF had created as this pretty much, it was a pretty clunky interface. We could communicate really well. I could email with no problem in the late 80s. But what was a problem was I couldn't see pictures very well. I couldn't find stuff very well. And when in 1991 we have the advent of the web, then all of a sudden things become so much clearer, so much easier to use. And at that point, it became something that the general user, you and I, could actually use. You didn't have to have a degree in computer science. You didn't have to have 30 hours of training to be able to move things around. You could just start saying, hey, look at what I can do, and get access. And you see AOL really coming up at this time, because they made it especially easy for you to use the web. And you can see how quickly the pace jumps up, because that's in 1991, basically the web is invented. You know, the internet's been around, but the browser, the user interface, using graphics to communicate, that is 1991. By 1993, you see large organizations have already started to put their websites online. So some examples are the White House and the United Nations put a website up. And it doesn't seem like much that they have a website, but that's really big. And I remember about 1995 when I'd be at the movies and it would say, you know, come to, you know, Chili's, and then underneath it would say www.chilis.com, and we just kind of laugh like, does anybody really know what that is? And now, you know, if you don't put it on there, then people think, what are you, an idiot that you don't have that kind of technology up? So, but the White House and the UN were examples of some of those major organizations that saw that it was really important to get online. And that's when the idea of those domain names that were mentioned back in 1984 becomes important, because the White House wants to be called whitehouse.com. They don't want to be called the President's House. You know, they'd like the White House. United Nations would like to be called unitednations.com. At this time, one of the authors that you've read, do you remember Hall Davidson? You read his work from when you were looking at digital copyright and you did the little quiz. He at this point was really involved in what was going on in the internet, and he went out to companies and he'd say, you know, ABC or CBS, you need to go out and you need to get that domain name. Even if you're not using it yet, you need to buy abc.com or nbc.net. And now, today, people that didn't go out and get those domain names are really regretting it. You know, you're going to get a lot more hits if you go to Southwest Airlines. You want Southwest Airlines, you want SWA, you want Southwest. If you're Southwest Airlines, you want to own all three of those domains, because if somebody puts it in, you want them to come to you first. You don't want them to say, oh, that's not the right one, I'm going to try United Airlines instead. So you want to own all of those domains, and you want them all to go to your central place. So when I tell you right now, go and get yourself an AIM account, an instant messaging account that's video instant messaging, whether you're using it or not, that's the same thing. Big bucks came out. You know, if ABC didn't purchase theirs before anybody else did, and somebody else went out and bought ABC, you think they're giving it up for free? No. I'd be happy to take $1 million off your hands if you want this domain name. Okay, so, and there was some big money that's transferred as a result. Okay, and I don't think ABC was one of those examples. So that's 1993. In 1997, in August, the number of nodes of the internet reaches 20 million. So we go from basically in 1991, the creation of the web, so saying people can use this. We had other things that were similar before, like Mosaic, but it didn't really count, to 1993, a few big companies putting their names online, 7 years later, so 6 years later, 20 million notes are online. That means 20 million people are getting on the computer. That's amazing. 6 years, we went from nothing, basically, to 20 million. Huge. Okay. In 1998, Microsoft Windows released Windows 98, which integrated the internet, so internet support. And that's when we start seeing IE, or Internet Explorer. And that's a really important time, because now, not only could those 20 million people still use it, probably a lot of those people at that time were using AOL, because that was easy to use, but now, whenever you purchased a computer that had Windows on it, which is basically every single PC that's purchased, you are going to get a free internet browser. So that meant now, everybody that had a computer had the technology needed to be able to access the internet if they had a phone line or cable system to connect. We're now talking in the billions of users, and just since 1998. Okay, so what is the internet? I'm talking about these nodes things, and that's kind of a, you probably don't know what that term means. So what I'm going to do is give you this little graphic so you can understand. Okay, think of the internet as this ephemeral thing, this thing that's out in the ether. It's really nothing. There's this nothingness of stuff, but really in that nothingness of stuff, there's all this data floating around, and it's really not any specific place. It's all of this, these places together. And you've got your computer right here. And you all have an internet service provider. So you might use Cox.net. We used Keyon for a while. What might be, any of you use other internet service providers at home? Here we're using just the UNLV service provider, but you have to pay money to somebody to be able to get access to the internet at home. So whoever you're paying money to is your internet service provider. So if I'm on my computer and I want to say, I want to go to Keeler's website, then what I'm going to do is I'm going to say, take me to Keeler's website by going to an internet browser. That's just the software that allows me to access it. That software then connects to my ISP, to my internet service provider, and says, okay, let's go to that place that she said she wanted. And that puts you out into this internet. Once you get into that internet, there are all these different interconnections, all of these different ways that questions can be asked to the computer. So if it says, I want to go to www.keelers.com, what it's going to do is it's going to start looking all over the internet for where that Keeler's is. And wherever the closest pathway or the fastest pathway, which isn't necessarily the closest, is to get to that website within this space of the internet, it's going to go that direction. So it might come here, and this is maybe where Keelers.com is, and my host is Keelers.com. So it says, finally, it takes me to this node, to this little packet, which that's my husband's computer at home, that's the server, and that's the host. And we can get our mail there, and you can get your website there. So when you get your own website, which you'll be doing in a few weeks, we're going to start working on that. You're going to have your own domain. You're not going to have your own domain name, but you're going to have your own space on the internet. So if you want to go to coe.nevada.edu/ckeeler, that's my space on the computer that's in the other room, the College of Education server at unlv.nevada.edu. So if I want to go there, I go from my house through my ESP onto the internet. It finds the fastest way to get to coe.nevada.edu. It finds that it's up here. This is coe.nevada.edu. And then within coe.nevada.edu, it says, oh, there's C. Keeler. And then within C. Keeler, I have all of my stuff that it can then look for. So that's what it's doing. And so there are nodes all over. And there are certain places where there are big nodes that packets go to, and they move around. We did a search once on my husband's, we were going from home to his office, and we live in Summerlin, and his office is out on Decatur, so about 3 to 5 miles away. And to get it there, it had to go, the packet, you could see where the packet went. It took about, you know, less than a second to do it, and that packet went all the way to Seattle. I think it went to someplace in Northern Nevada or Northern California, and then back to Las Vegas before it got to Decatur in Las Vegas, because that was the fastest way for it to do it. And it will automatically choose the fastest path regardless of where it is. Okay, so some vocabulary that you need to know when we're looking at the internet, and you probably know these, but you don't really know what they're called. First is a URL, or Universal Resource Locator. Universal means it can just be anywhere. Resource means what is that thing that you're looking for, and locator means what is it, its address. So just like the postal worker that comes to your house knows your address, each address on the internet, or each place on the internet, has a unique address. So coe.nevada.edu/ckeeler/computers/index.html. That's our homepage. If you hit instead /materials.html, then you're going to go to links or materials or resources. You're going to get to a different address. So every place on the internet must have a unique address, and that unique address is called your URL, and that's what you put up in the top section where it says HTTP. The other thing that you aren't going to need to know as well, but we'll talk about it later in the semester, is hypertext markup language, HTML. You are not going to be writing any HTML. Well, you might use some HTML in this class, but you're really not going to be writing it. You'll be copying it and pasting it. But when computer nerds sit down and want to write a web page, they'll often use, or we used to use, HTML. So when I wanted to write my first web page, which I did about in 1998, I think, all I did was I put in all of these codes. How many of you have done any programming at all? Like basic, HTML, anything like that. So you know what those look like. So my web page that was maybe this big, it was this long if you look at it in code, and it has all this stuff that if you look at it, and I'll show it to you in a few weeks, it won't make any sense to anybody who can't read that code. But that's what it is. It's the programming language behind it. And we're not going to be using HTML. We're going to be using web editors to create our stuff, which is pretty much what people use nowadays. The one thing I just want to reiterate, we talked about this before, but as we are going on to the internet, just like as you will take your students on the internet, or at least I hope you will, you need to make sure that you appreciate the ethics and the safety and human issues that go along with this. You're not, because when we get onto that internet, we go into that great expanse where everything is. That includes all of your porn sites. That includes access to all of your, you know, creepy, geeky people out there. So you want to make sure that when you put them out there, you're going to say, this is the address that you're going to go to. It's kind of like when you have students selling items for schools now. It will say, your child is not to take this around the neighborhood. Your child is only to ask people they know, friends, family members, people from your work, if they want to buy something. Children today are told not to just go into the neighborhood and ask to sell items. Same thing. You're not going to say, just go walk around in the neighborhood and see what you can find. You're going to say, you need to go to this person's address. You wouldn't send them down to the street to talk to somebody that they don't know. On Halloween, you're going to probably walk with your kids if they're small, and you're going to check their candy. Same thing when they're on the internet. You're going to walk with those kids, and you're going to say, this is an okay address, this is an okay address, and I'm going to keep an eye on you to make sure that you're at that okay address and you're not somewhere you're not supposed to be, because it can be very unsafe. Again, children do put themselves at risk, and we talked about this before. This is a graph, I think we might have seen it before. Did we see this one before? Yes, they're willing to share their intimate details. So don't think that just because they're going on that they're not going to do it. Just be careful. It is your responsibility to teach them how to be safe, responsible, and effective. It's also their parents' responsibility, but you cannot expect their parents to do it all. You need to be there. You can maybe go ahead and have a family night, and during that family night, you guys talk about how to be internet safe. And you can even have your kids teach parents how to be internet safe because you've taught a lesson on it. But make sure that you take the responsibility in the school environment that they know what's safe and what's not safe. I think we also went over these issues, is that right? How to set up your computer room so that it will be safe, or your computer opportunities. Does this look familiar? So for Willard, she said, there are five things you need to do. First, you need to protect your students by not putting them in a potentially negative environment. Next, you need to prepare them. Let them know that you might go out there and find something that you don't expect to find, and tell them how to deal with that when that happens. You need to focus on an educational purpose. You never say, go out and play online. You give them a direct issue to deal with, a direct question to answer, a direct piece of information to find. So everything has an educational purpose. You focus on, you teach them about what is safe and what is responsible. So you include that as part of your curriculum. You have a clear, well-communicated policy. If I see you at that site, then you are going to lose your computer privileges, or you will be in the dean's office for the next hour. And you make sure you monitor them, you supervise what's going on, and you swiftly and appropriately discipline them when they choose to not follow those directions. So what exists for education on the internet? Given all that stuff, that there's a lot of really negative, scary stuff out there, there is also incredibly valuable educational resources online. And so that's what you're going to be spending today and next session looking at. Just a very, very small subset of what those are, some that I like. One thing that you can do with students is you can have them do a web quest. Does anybody know what a web quest is? Any of you done a web quest? Okay. Well, a web quest, it was created by Bernie Dodge out of San Diego State University, I believe. And he came up with the idea of, instead of just saying, go out and do an internet search on this, that if we gave it an educational purpose and we put it into this particular format, then it would make it easier for kids. Plus, we'd be guaranteed that they would, we wouldn't be guaranteed, we'd increase our probability that they would appropriately use the technology. So what a web quest does is it says, this is your issue, this is your problem, or this is your task. Once you reach your task, and often they're really fun tasks, like you are a, you're a miner and you need to go out and find these items, okay? So it gives you a task, and then it says, these are the sites that you can go to, pre-design which 5 sites or 10 sites or 30 sites or 2 sites where you can go to get that information. These are the questions that you need to be able to answer at the end. This is how you need to present your information at the end. And then this is how you will know whether or not you have completed your task. And usually there are simulated experiences which are really quite fun, like what you did with Decisions last week. So it's a very structured way to have students on the internet. What you know is if you walk by their computer and you see that they're on a site that isn't one of those 5 sites that were in the web quest or the web quest itself, they're not doing what they're supposed to do. And it's quick and easy for you to say, that's not okay, and enforce whatever discipline you had planned. So that's one example. There are lots of other examples out there, and we'll look at those next time. But today you're going to be looking at least one web quest. So I want to make sure that you are aware of what that is. When you go out to look at a site for educational purposes, there are lots of things that you need to consider. And you've read about these with the Kathy Schrock article, that if you haven't read it, get on it. It's great. Also, we talked about when you read the Alan November article about safety online. Those are all issues to keep in mind. So some of the questions are, how do you know if this is a credible site? And there's some great ways to find out. For instance, there is a website called Easy Who Is. And if I go to easywhois.com, it says, okay, look up the domain name and see who it belongs to. So let's see, who owns Keelers.com? Okay, this is owned by Mike Keeler, and look it, it's got his address, it's got his phone number, all kinds of stuff. That's his work stuff, so don't you, well, you've got all my stuff anyway. But you can find out exactly who owns that. So if you're seeing that something inappropriate is happening, you can go and find out. Or if you're not sure what the site that was up there, if it was really appropriate, if it was really intended by somebody who was a positive force in the community, this is a way you could find it out. Another option is using Alta Vista Host. And what this does, let's go to Alta Vista. Alta Vista is another search engine. And this used to be probably the premier search engine out there, but since that time we've gone more Google and Yahoo. You can type in host and then put in the name of a website. So we'll put in www.martinlutherking.org. And I believe what this says is it tells you the people that are hosting sites that relate to this. where it links to. So what you can look on here and see, if the top few ones are about a piece on slamming Kwanzaa and will host hate, that's going to tell you maybe this isn't a really appropriate site. Remember I talked about how martinlutherking.org is led by not a necessarily positive organization. Another thing you can do here is instead of hitting in host, you can type in link. And this will show everybody that links to, all the people that link to that site. So if everybody that links to this, we've got some good things, but we also have, the second one is on hate and deception on the web. That tells you maybe that's not very good. And if you go in and use the Easy Who Is that I showed you before, what you'll see is that it's owned by Stormfront, and it will tell you that because they cannot keep that information private. Okay, so we can know if a site is credible by knowing who developed it, who's linking to it, and where do they link from within it out. Another thing that we need to do is judge the quality of a site. And what tends to happen, especially with kids, but probably with all of us too, is when you do a search on Google or on Yahoo or on AltaVista, whatever the first 5 sites are or the first 10 sites are, you're going to look at those. Anything else, you're not going to waste your time going forward. You're going to refine your search term to get something else. Well, what that's saying is that whatever comes on that screen first is really, really important information. And know that people who know how to manipulate the internet know that that's the most important thing. So if I want Christy Keeler, every time you type in Christy Keeler, it to come up to one of my sites, I can create a little what we call Google bomb on the internet. And I can, how it works is the more sites that link to Christy Keeler or this one site, then that's going to make my name come up on the top of that list. And no, it's not going to happen if you look, because I haven't done a Google bomb. But what will happen is I can use a robot to create 1 million sites that all link to coe.nevada.edu/ckeeler. Then that means that there are 1 million people that are pointing at that site. And so then when you go to it on Google, or when you put in Christy Keeler on Google, that's going to come up because there are 1 million people who think that that's a really important site. But really, it's not 1 million people. It was me who created a Google bomb. So know that yes, there is some credibility a lot to somebody whose name comes up first, but not always. So we need to be aware that there are ways to change that. Determining the educational usefulness. How do you know if this is an educationally useful site or not? You can evaluate it. And what are some of the criteria that you'd use? Who the author is. So we deal with credibility and stuff. What about, are you going to use it today in your classroom? Why would you? What would you want to know about it? Okay, if other people have used it and found that it was useful, okay. But you honestly don't need to know if other people have used it. What can you do? Just go hang out, look at it, and you'll see, is that site that you're looking at, does it relate to the curriculum that I'm teaching today? Does it align with the instructional strategies that I'm using today? And if it does not, then that's not a suitable website for you to use educationally. If it does, if it's going to further those goals and reinforce the concepts that you're teaching, then that's what you need to be using. If it doesn't, then you shouldn't be wasting your students' time on it. So the bottom line is, if it doesn't have an educational usefulness for today in class, then don't waste anybody's time with it. Okay, what I'm going to do is you are each going to have a website assignment, which is very much like the assignment that you just completed on instructional software. 1, 2, 3. What you're going to be doing, though, this time is you're going to be evaluating websites. The difference between this one and the last one, other than the fact that you're evaluating websites, is that you are going to be creating the evaluation form yourself. So first, you have to create the evaluation form, and it has to be based on what you've read in your readings and what you've learned about creating things like forms, and then you will have to use it. So there are some quick things that I want to review with you that you'll need to know for this assignment. Some of the requirements are, you're going to have to create in Word a form. So if I'm going to create a form, I'm going to give it a name, and maybe you're going to want to put your evaluator's name, the person who's doing it, evaluator's name. Okay, and you want it to look good, so I'll maybe bold and center that. Oops, I don't have my right ones up. Remember, you can change your tools. Okay, so center that, maybe even make that a little bigger. Okay, evaluator's name. Now, if I want to input somebody's name here, remember that I told you you can use form fields before? And the way that you're going to use those is first you have to view the toolbar for forms. So you're going to go down to Toolbar, Form. Oops, that's drawing. That's not what I wanted. Okay, you're going to go down to View, Toolbars, Forms. And there, I get this little thing that says, what do you want to put in this form? Right now, I'm going to want to put somebody's name there. So I'm going to click on ABC, which means I can put in text. And I might even want to underline that. So I'm going to highlight this section and put underline. And then maybe I want date evaluated. But I don't want this underlined. Date evaluated. And then I'm going to put in another one. And this one I'm going to also make underlined. Okay. And I'm going to say, that's one way that you can use forms. Another is by putting checkboxes. And maybe you'll say, is this site credible? Is this site credible? Okay, and again, I don't want it to be underlined. And then I might put yes or no. Now, to be able to put in a checkbox like you've been using on the previous forms, all I have to do is click right here, and I can click right in front of my no and put in that. Okay? And maybe, and then of course I'd put in why, and then I could put in a little this so that I could put in my answers. Okay, and these are just examples of what you might want to put in it. The other thing that you must include in it is a table, maybe saying, you know, what are the benefits of this or what are not, or these are all the elements that I'm going to consider, and these are the reasons that I came out with it. And you all know how to do tables. That was taught earlier in the semester. The other thing that you must do in this, other than using a table and using some of the form fields, is you must save it as stationary. So when you go to File, Save, instead of just hitting save like you normally would, you're going to go to Format and go down to Word Document Stationery and hit save. And what you'll see then is when you find it online, see how it looks like it's got two little things instead of one, two little files? Whenever I open this, it's going to be clean every single time I open it. You're going to email me that file, that Word stationary document. That's what you're going to turn in to me via email. You're going to also turn in to me two website evaluations that are going to be printed out using your form. Okay? Any questions about that?
Yeah, can you go back through that file and name that